From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Simon Marks. Today, the first in a series of special holiday editions of our program, we talk to the author of a new book about an old composer, Ludwig van Beethoven, as you've never heard about him before.
Even if he says he wanted a wife, did he really? Because I think he knew he had to pour all his creativity, all his emotion into his music. And if he had married, if he had become a father, would we still have had the music?
That's Beethoven, the man revealed. Our conversation with author John Suchet about the composer's life, his passions, and how he maneuvered his way around a police state. It's all coming up on FSN Reports after our summary of the day's main news.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Daniel Renches. The United Nations is preparing to increase the size of its 7,000-strong peacekeeping force in South Sudan. There are concerns that the world's newest country could descend into civil war after a split between the two major groups represented by the president and former vice president. From Washington, Rob Flynn reports.
The United Nations is set to nearly double its peacekeeping force in South Sudan from 6,800 to close to 12,000 to stave off violence as fighting continues between the government and rebel forces. Today, Donald Booth, U.S. Special Envoy in the country, announced that South Sudan President Salva Kiir is prepared to meet with the rebels, led by Riek Machar, amid reports that the former vice president is also willing to find a peaceful solution. Additionally, the U.S. has positioned approximately 150 Marines just outside the country's borders, prepared to enter to protect U.S. interests and nationals should the need arise. Rob Flynn, Washington.
Apple stocks rallied after the company announced a deal to supply its iPhone to China Mobile. The partnership gives Apple much greater access to China's mobile phone market, with an estimated 1.2 billion users. Rachel Silverman has more.
The long-anticipated deal between Apple and China Mobile brings the iPhone to the world's biggest phone company. The iPhone is already available in China through two smaller carriers, but this deal links it with a bigger network and the marketing power of state-owned China Mobile. The iPhone faces tough competition in China from less expensive smartphones running Google's Android software. Forecasts of possible increased iPhone sales as a result of the deal vary widely, from 10 million to 40 million in the coming year. The iPhone will go on sale in Apple and China Mobile stores in mid-January in time for the gift-buying rush that typically comes with the Lunar New Year. Rachel Silverman, San Francisco.
Two members of the Pussy Riot punk rock band have been released from jail in Russia under an amnesty. The artists were sentenced to 2 years in prison, each for performing an anti-Putin punk prayer in one of Moscow's central cathedrals last year. Daria Bondarchuk reports from Moscow.
Maria Alyoshina was released from the penal colony number 2 in Nizhny Novgorod. The activist said she was not aware of the upcoming release and was taken away from the prison early in the morning secretly in a private car. Her fellow activist Nadezhda Telakonnikova was freed later in the afternoon from a hospital prison in the Krasnoyarsk region. The young woman said the release is, quote, a burden of responsibility, including to those who stayed behind bars. The freed Pussy Riot members plan to work together on a human rights project helping people who are in prison. The case of the performers, who were charged with hooliganism based on religious hatred, fell under the amnesty announced by the Russian authorities to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the Russian Constitution. Daria Bondarchuk, Moscow.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. The inventor of the Kalashnikov assault rifle, Mikhail Kalashnikov, has died at the age of 94. The assault rifle, the AK-47, is one of the world's most widely used firearms. Anya Ardaeva reports from Moscow.
Mikhail Kalashnikov's relatives told Russian state TV that the designer's health has been deteriorating recently. He spent 2 weeks at a cardiology center in May and was flown to Moscow in June for treatment. Mikhail Kalashnikov's assault rifle, which he invented at the age of 20, has become the world's most widely used weapon. He has created several other guns with the common characteristics of simple design, reliability, and ease of maintenance. Mikhail Kalashnikov said repeatedly during his interviews that he invented his guns to allow people to protect themselves and not to attack each other. Even though he was honored by the Russian state, Mikhail Kalashnikov never made a fortune from inventing the most well-known gun. The manufacturing company Izhmash has patented the weapon only in 1997, and by 2006 it accounted for only 10% of the global production of AK guns. Anya Ardaeva, Moscow.
The US has raised eyebrows in Qatar and Yemen by accusing two well-known Islamic fundraisers of funneling millions to al-Qaeda-related jihadists. Priscilla Huff has more from Washington.
Abdulrahman Al-Nuyami is a well-regarded professor at Qatar University who has helped the ruling Al-Thani family with their charitable efforts. Abd al-Wahhab al-Humakani is a Yemeni who has worked on the U.S.-backed National Dialogue Conference, a group working with that country's democratic transition. The U.S. has named both of those men as specially designated global terrorists in order to freeze their assets, suspecting both of them have funneled millions to al-Qaeda-related groups. The U.S. Treasury insists that charitable donations must not be used to support violence. The men deny the allegations. Priscilla Huff, Washington.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Daniel Wrench's reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks. Welcome to this special edition of FSN Reports. Now, it's a pretty good bet that if you only recognise one bit of classical music, it's that one, the Fifth Symphony, written by the man our guest today simply refers to as the Master. Ludwig van Beethoven, born in the German city of Bonn in December 1770, he died in Vienna in March 1827, but he is still widely discussed today, the predominant musical figure of his age, an age that bridged the classical and romantic eras in European music. So joining me to talk about all things Beethoven is an old friend and colleague of mine, John Suchet, whose new book, Beethoven, The Man Revealed, is in bookstores now. And John joins us today from his studio at Classic FM in London, where he plays Beethoven and occasionally some other composers to a national radio audience in the UK every morning. John, it is great having you with us today. Welcome to the programme.
Thank you, Simon. Good to speak to you again after all these years.
Absolutely. So why another book on Beethoven? Because I think this is your sixth, and this is the one in which you are revealing the man. What's different about this one?
Yes. Well, you see, as you said a little earlier in your introduction, he's still discussed today, what, nearly 200 years after his death. He's in the news more often than I can tell you, whether it's for a musical reason, like a new manuscript has been found or new sketch pads have been found because he filled hundreds of sketchbooks, or whether it's some detail of his life, speculation as to who the one woman that we know of who returned his love, who she might have been, because we still don't know for sure, his hair being analysed for DNA to see if we can find out what caused his deafness. And the latest news, which I can give you, is that we actually possess fragments of his skull. It's a long story as to how we got them, and you haven't got the time to hear all of that. But once they are established as being his, they're going to be DNA tested, and we might one day find out the greatest mystery in the history of music, in the history of art, what caused Beethoven's deafness. So this man is in the news the whole time, and I haven't written the final definitive account of his life. There will be hundreds more books to come over hundreds more years.
But you have written a very detailed explanation, not, as you put it, of Beethoven the god, as he's often treated by modern audiences, but of Beethoven the man. And let me take you all the way back to his childhood. I mean, we all know he had this very brutalized childhood at the hands of a very stern and demanding father. What do you conclude as a result of that? Would he have become the man that he was had it not been for that somewhat harrowing experience?
Yes, well, you know, I think the word brutalising, even the word harrowing, is perhaps putting it a little bit too strongly. The father became an alcoholic. We know that. He used to go out drinking with, actually, the musician that he employed to teach the young boy. And he would come back in the middle of the night and drag Beethoven, the boy, out of bed and stand him at the piano and occasionally rap his knuckles. OK, it wasn't that nice. And Beethoven actually resented it for the rest of his life. But it wasn't that bad because, actually, the father recognised the boy's musical talent very early on and thought to himself, aha, well, if Mozart's father can make money out of his young lad, I'll make money out of mine. And once he realised the potential, he actually didn't treat him that badly. And we do owe Johann, Beethoven's father, one great, great debt. He employed, when Beethoven was just 10 or 11 years of age, the most perfect teacher for him. The man was right in every respect. And that was the man. His name was Christian Gottlob Neefe, who really knew he had something on his hands here. And Beethoven himself, when he dedicated a piece to him, once he reached Vienna, said, "You taught me everything."
And when he reached Vienna, you write in the book, Beethoven was to live there for just over 34 years until his death. For the first half of that time, roughly, Vienna was a city at almost permanent war. For the second half, it was what today would be called a police state. That must have had an impact on not just the way he was living, but the way in which he was creating.
Absolutely. And, do you know, I believe possibly, probably, the most significant historical event of the last, oh, I don't know, several hundred years, if not a thousand years, was the French Revolution. I believe it changed the course of history, literally. And remember, it happened just 3 years before Beethoven reached Vienna. And 1 year before he reached Vienna, and indeed in the year following, what did the French revolutionaries do? They cut off the head of their king, swiftly followed by his queen, which was the longest standing monarchy in mainland Europe after the French, the Habsburgs in Vienna. And that's where the young Beethoven was in his early 20s. And it was a city living in fear. And that was the beginning of what we today call the police state, as you said, I say it in my book, because Metternich clamped down. It was a police state. There were spies everywhere because the monarchy was determined not to lose its head, literally. And Beethoven lived in that era, in that city, in that sense of fear. So he was influenced by the historical events around him.
And influenced in what sense? I mean, when one thinks of sort of a modern day police state, if you think of the way in which artists found their lives being constrained in the middle of the Cold War in the former Soviet Union, was there anything equivalent taking place in Vienna as far as Beethoven's creativity being limited was concerned? Did he have to think carefully about what he was composing? How did that translate?
Well, you know, interesting, this very, very, very nice point you've raised. Just to move it forward a few years, the composer who was directly influenced by that and whose life, in a sense, was moulded by that was Schubert, Beethoven's young contemporary. Because as the police state happened, Schubert would hold little evenings with his friends in his house or their house called Schubertiade because it wasn't safe to go out. And that moulded Schubert. Now, although he was a contemporary of Beethoven, Beethoven, remember, was a generation older than him. And so he didn't take quite so much notice of the rules and regulations. Now, we know that his favourite tavern, his favourite inn in Vienna, was the Schwan Inn, the Swan Inn, in the Neue Markt in the centre of the city. It's actually a bookshop now. I've been to see exactly where it was. And at the back of this inn, there was a table, a couple of tables, where the exiles from Bonn in Germany, which, of course, as you said, was where he was from, where the exiles used to gather of an evening to drink and talk about their homeland and how awful it was that Napoleon's troops had occupied Bonn. They were marching up and down the streets in their uniforms. But they had to be very careful what they said because, of course, as I say, spies everywhere. Did Beethoven care? No, he didn't. Not only that, but his deafness was taking hold. He was finding it difficult to hear what people say. So I imagine at the back of this inn, he would suddenly shout out some really insulting remark, maybe about the emperor, no less, and the spies up at the bar would turn around quickly and then they'd say, oh, it's that eccentric deaf composer. He's no harm to anyone and ignore him. That's my theory.
And he would have been at the back of the inn, I gather, because personal hygiene, not a top priority for Ludwig
it's
van Beethoven.
It's true, Simon. I struggle with this. His favourite restaurants, we know, kept a table at the back for him on his own, because if he sat with other people, he tended to upset them with his eating habits. There are a couple of documented occasions, actually. He was once at a restaurant in the Vienna woods with his friends, and he ordered lamb cutlets. And when the waiter brought them, he looked at them and said, "These are disgusting." And he picked up the plate and he threw it at the waiter's head. And the lamb cutlets stuck to the waiter's face before dropping off. And his friends were horrified. So was the waiter. But suddenly the waiter, seeing who had done it, he had a reputation, Beethoven, the gravy trickled down the corner of his face into his mouth. And he went, Very tasty, this gravy. And the moment was diffused.
So a complex personality.
Yes.
And talk a little bit about the complexity of his relationship with Haydn and Mozart.
Yes, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Can you imagine those three household names today, those three greatest composers, dare I say, alive at the same time? Unbelievable. But as far as we know, the three never met together. Beethoven met Mozart once. He went to Vienna in 1787 at the age of 16 and a quarter to play for him, and Mozart was seriously impressed, and he agreed to take him on as a pupil. And but unfortunately, when Beethoven got back to his lodgings, there was an urgent letter from his father saying, come home immediately, your mother's very ill and we fear for her life. So he had to leave immediately. So he never took lessons with Mozart. And, you know, musically speaking, that's a source of some regret, two of these greatest names not working together. But I think it's a good thing. What if Mozart, the perfectionist, had sort of smoothed off the rough edges, rounded the corners of the revolutionary composer that we know today? And with Haydn was actually the reason Beethoven went to Vienna at the age of just under 22, where he stayed for the rest of his life, because Haydn had passed through Bonn, seen one of his compositions in manuscript form, and said, my goodness, this is good. Come to Vienna, I will teach you. And so Haydn was his first teacher in Vienna. But, you know, Haydn was a venerable elderly chap by then, and Beethoven was a young man in a hurry. And he said later, I learned nothing from Haydn.
Do you think that those men at the time understood the place that they were going to occupy in the history of classical music? Did they have a sense of the importance of these conversations that they were having?
Well, dare I say it, Simon, Beethoven, yes. The number of anecdotal evidences we have of things that he said on one occasion, I think it's the second Razumovsky string quartet. No, I think it's the first. Second movement begins with a solo cello, which the cellists in Vienna and in Moscow, where it was sent, refused to play because it begins on a single note. Da-da-dum-dum-da-da-dum-dum-da-da-da-da-da-da. And they said, you're making a fool of us, Beethoven. You're just having fun at our expense. And they refused to play it. And Beethoven said, my music is not for you. It's for future generations.
Now, Beethoven, while he had querulous relationships with some in the field of professionalism, also had difficulties in terms of his personal life.
I think
there were at least three women that were possible suitors for him.
Yes.
The first one turned down his proposal, saying that he was so ugly and half-crazy.
Half-crazy.
Tell us the story of the personal side of his life.
Well, he so wanted a wife. And when his great young helper, Ferdinand Ries, left him in Vienna, came to London and married an English girl and wrote back and said, I've married a beautiful English girl. He said, oh, I'm so envious. If only I could find a wife. He proposed marriage, we know, on at least three occasions, turned down each time. As you say, the first one described him as ugly and half crazy, which I think, I mean, that's worth 100 pages of a formal biography. That tells me more about Beethoven than anything. There was one woman that we know returned his love, the only one that we know who did so, and it's because of a letter that he wrote, a lengthy letter to her after their brief relationship. We don't know if it was consummated. I've read that letter. I've translated it. I've agonized and analyzed every word in it. I still don't know whether it actually happened. But it ends, my angel, my all, my very self, if we cannot forever be together, then we must forever remain apart. So we have to assume they were in love with each other. Could she have been a married woman? There's great speculation that she was Antoni Brentano, who was married with children. To this day, we don't know who she was. But you know, Simon, my theory is, even if he says he wanted a wife, did he really? Because I think he knew he had to pour all his creativity, all his emotion into his music. And if he had married, if he had become a father, wouldn't those emotions have been somewhat, not so much diluted, but they would have had to move into other areas? Would we still have had the music that we have today? And the same goes for his deafness. Without his deafness, which today could most certainly be treated, definitely improved, if not cured, would we have the late quartets? So I think some of the elements of Beethoven's life that even he himself, certainly his deafness, regarded as a tragedy, perhaps they're to our benefit.
So let's talk about his deafness. You relate in the book this letter that he wrote on the 29th of June, 1801, which is fully a quarter of a century before he passed away, to an old friend, which is the first letter in which Beethoven discloses, as far as we know, to anyone, that he's having difficulty with his hearing.
This is true. And he was living in Vienna. He was 30 years and a half. And the friend he chose to write it to was back in Bonn. He was a boy he had known as a teenager. So hundreds of miles away from Vienna. That's the first point. And the second point is this boy was now a qualified doctor. So no surprise that he chose to write it to someone not in Vienna, because the last thing he wanted was for knowledge of his deafness to get out, because he was just really beginning to make his name as not just a performer, but a composer. And that's what he wanted more than anything. The last thing he needed was for concert halls, impresarios and so on to say, but he's going deaf, he'll be ruined. So he wrote this letter to somebody living hundreds of miles away and asked for medical advice, to which the response was, go and see your doctor. And he went to one doctor after another. It's a blockage here, Beethoven, it'll go. But you know, somehow he knew, and he was right. But it was a long, slow, gradual process. He didn't become what we would today call stone deaf or totally deaf for another, oh, it's impossible to say exactly, but at least 15 to 20 years. And all through that time, as his deafness worsened, his music became all the more noble and heroic. It's one of the great miracles of art.
And how do you think he was doing that? I mean, was he still hearing the music in his inner ear, even at the worst points?
Yes, very important to understand that he, in that letter that he wrote when he was 30 and a half, he says, for the last 3 years, I've had a problem with my hearing. Now, he was very notoriously careless about dates, but on something as important as this, let's give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he was round about 27, maybe 26, maybe 28, when he first noticed a problem. If I'm in company and someone speaks, I can't hear them. And if I ask them to speak up and they shout, it hurts my ears. So around 27 or so, by which time, Simon, he was already one of, together with Haydn, the most famous composer and performer in Europe. So he knew what music sounded like. He was a child prodigy. We've already discussed his father. He knew what music sounded like. And because of his particular and peculiar genius, once his hearing started to go, he could still hear the music in his head. Now, that's not to minimise the tragedy overtaking him, because in Heiligenstadt, the little village where he went to rest his ears, where he writes his last will and testament just 2 years after that letter, I think he is reserving the right to himself to take his own life if ever the day comes when he can no longer hear his own music. And that day never truly came, but it got worse and worse and worse, and he never took the easy way out.
And when he did die, the reaction to his death in Vienna was seismic.
Phenomenal. More than 20,000 people turned out for the funeral cortege. There was actually a riot. Soldiers on horseback had to quell the crowd. And, you know, part of that, I think, was almost a collective guilt, certainly so among the city's aristocrats, that they had allowed Mozart to pass on almost unnoticed. We're not going to let this one go. And he was an eccentric, and, you know, they would go to his concerts because they never knew what might happen at his concerts, like he would knock the candelabra out of a boy's hand while he's performing. But they knew they had something special in their midst. And that funeral, actually, I was surprised when I researched that funeral to see just how many people turned up, because they weren't that good to him during his lifetime. He didn't have that many people that he could call his friends. But for the general public, remember, Beethoven wrote for you and me, not royalty. He wrote for you and me, every man and every woman. And they were the people who recognised that and who turned out to honour him at his funeral.
And let me, with that in mind, bring you right up to date. We speak in an era, certainly on this side of the Atlantic, in which classical music radio is in decline. This has been another year in which a number of classical music stations have either changed their formats or laid off their human staff and replaced them with computers that are playing out computer-generated playlists. Do you have worries that Beethoven's legacy, and indeed the legacy of an array of other composers, is at some risk here, or does the music simply transcend it and this is a blip in time that we'll all get past?
No, the answer's no, and it's not even a blip. You're right about classical music stations. I work at one myself. And if our numbers, if our listeners are in decline, it is for one reason only, nothing to do with the music. It's to do with the fact, just what I'm about to say, imagine saying this to Beethoven or Mozart or Haydn or Wagner or Mahler, any of these great names. Guess what? I can carry every single note that you composed in my pocket. They would say, what? What are you talking about? You need an orchestra. You need to hire a hall. In my pocket, as I speak to you, Simon, I have every note, more or less, that Beethoven composed, every note that every opera that Wagner composed, all the Mahler symphonies, they're on my smartphone. How could a man who lived 200 years ago begin to understand that? I can summon his music up in the quiet of my own home whenever I want. That's why classical music stations are in decline, but not really. They're simply adjusting to the new technology which allows us to enjoy great works of art whenever and wherever we want. And you said to me, does it mean classical music is on the decline? Absolutely the reverse.
John Suchet, it's a fantastic book, and I should say that it's a book that works for musicologists and for everybody else. You've got all these footnotes at the back. It's annotated, so the scholastic research is there for everybody to see, but it's also an extraordinarily accessible book for people that just want to learn more about Beethoven. It's called Beethoven, The Man Revealed. John Suchet wrote it, and it's published on this side of the Atlantic by Grove Atlantic. John, I'm going to give you a chance to be the DJ on our program now. if we were to play ourselves out with one bit of Beethoven, one recording, would you suggest we go out with, and then we'll go away and find it?
All right. Well, I will tell you what it is. In 1968, a German pianist by the name of Jörg Demus recorded the piano sonata Opus 110. It was the middle of the final set of piano sonatas that Beethoven ever composed. Those sonatas have no names. He's very profoundly deaf by now. His health is in terminal decline. He's been through a dreadful court case with his sister-in-law, which, by the way, was entirely of his own making. And then he wrote these three sonatas. And that middle one, I believe, stands as his autobiography. He is telling us about his deafness. And this recording by Jörg Demus was done in Beethoven's birthhouse in Bonn on his last piano. And when I bought the recording in that house, the woman who sold it to me said, this is very special because after this recording was made, we covered the keys of the piano because they're now too delicate. So this is the last time that Beethoven's voice was heard.
Music of Beethoven, concluding this special edition of FSN Reports. Tomorrow, a look back at the major stories making news in Britain during 2013 and a look ahead to 2014. That's tomorrow, but for now, I'm Simon Marks in Washington. For everyone with FSN everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.